Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you this morning. Some of you may not have recognized me because I have let my hair grow and revert back to its natural color, which is the latest pandemic trend, you know. But my son, Ian, who is 12, he let his hair grow during the pandemic as well, and he loves it. He wants to keep it that way. But one day, Ian and I were walking down by the locks, and someone came up to us and commented on how well-behaved my granddaughter was. Yep, and I thought, you know, that's wrong on a number of levels. But I just said, thank you. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with the Pregnancy Center, we're a local interdenominational Christian ministry, which began 36 years ago, and our whole reason for existence is to help women and men who are facing pregnancy, parenting, or post-abortion concerns with emotional, physical, and spiritual support in the unconditional love of Jesus Christ. And all of our services are free and confidential. So we offer pregnancy tests and options counseling for those who are dealing with an unexpected pregnancy and are unsure what to do. Now, we do not provide or assist in arranging abortions, but what we do provide is a safe environment to make a pregnancy decision that's fully informed and free from external influences and pressures. So every client is treated with compassion and respect, no matter what they choose, because if someone is standing at that crossroads, every choice at that point is a difficult one. Every choice, whether it's abortion, adoption, or parenting, involves some kind of loss. And in fact, the level of distress that women feel in this situation is similar to facing a terminal illness. And women often feel alone in their decision, on top of bearing the brunt of judgment from other people, whether real or perceived. So that's why we feel it's so important at the Pregnancy Center to walk alongside women in their journey, to let them know that they're loved and they're not alone. And so we offer this emotional and practical support through our care closet, which has gently used maternity and baby clothes from 0 to 24 months, diapers, baby food, every baby item you can imagine. And we also have a 16-week pregnancy and parenting education program that's both before and after the birth. And clients earn baby bucks to spend to get brand new items in our store. And then they learn about all aspects of pregnancy, labor, newborn care, etc., so they can feel confident as a new parent. And the father of the baby is encouraged to attend as well with his partner. Now, if someone chooses to pursue adoption, we don't do the legal part, but we do assist birth mothers in making an adoption plan, connecting them to an agency, and providing continuing support to the birth mom after placement. We also provide bereavement support for miscarriage. And additionally, we offer post-abortion support for women who may be struggling emotionally after an abortion decision. Now, we want women to know that they can find hope and healing and forgiveness in Christ, no matter how many years or often decades have passed since their abortion. So now that was a very quick recap of what we do. And if you want any more information about any of that, or if you want to know how you can get involved as a volunteer or a monthly donor or a board member, just talk with me after the service. But this morning, I'm going to talk about the ministry from a little bit different angle than you might be used to. We're going to go beneath the surface to shed some light on the foundational reasons of why pregnancy care ministry is necessary in the first place. So we're talking big picture here. It'll all make sense at the end. So there's an ancient Chinese proverb that states, if you want to know what water is, don't ask the fish. And why don't you ask the fish? Well, because fish don't know they're wet. And that's the way it is with culture. It can be hard to understand our own cultural environment because it's all we know. It's what we're immersed in. It's what we take for granted as normal. We may not even be aware of how we think and how we see the world until, of course, we encounter someone who thinks and sees the world quite a bit differently. And I'm sure it comes as no surprise to anyone that the abortion issue is controversial. Bit of an understatement, right? And so it's really hard to have open, constructive, respectful conversations with people without defenses immediately going up and everyone retreating to their own corners. Why is it so difficult to communicate? And we know there's tremendous fears and pressures surrounding becoming a parent, but what's driving that? Like, why is there so much fear? Why is there so much pressure? There are a lot of negative perceptions about pregnancy centers out there. And you've probably seen it on the news, on social media, on popular television shows, from politicians to celebrities. Why is pregnancy care ministry so controversial in today's culture? One of my volunteers once commented, "You know, but all we do is help people. You know, why are they so against what we do when all we do is help people?" Well, one answer is that we're Christians and Jesus told us we'd be persecuted. The world hated Jesus, so the world will hate us too. And this is true. However, I think it's true at a much deeper level than many of us might realize if all we're doing is looking at the issues on the surface. And what do we see on the surface? Well, in A Practical Guide to Culture, John Stonestreet and Brett Kunkel use the analogy of the ocean to represent culture. And this is how they put it. Like the ocean, culture has both seen and unseen elements. Though cultural undercurrents are invisible, they powerfully pressure us to conform to their collective assumptions about the world. Cultural issues, however, are more like waves, seen, heard, and felt. Understanding both is critical if we're to keep our heads above water. Now, it seems to me that the crashing waves that we're seeing in culture, that we hear and read regarding abortion in the media and on social media, movies, television shows, distressing arguments with friends and family or coworkers, these are the things that we see and feel on the surface. But what about under the surface, the undercurrents? C.S. Lewis said, "The most dangerous ideas in society are not the ones that are being argued. They're the ones that are assumed." So I believe that two of the undercurrents that are affecting the abortion debate the most right now is one, the concept of sexual autonomy, and two, the value of children. Now, that second one can go in both directions. On one extreme, there's the belief that children are an inconvenience or a hindrance to the life you want. But there's the opposite extreme, that children are this luxury commodity, and you can't have them until everything in your life is going perfectly and you've got a ton of money. So devaluing children, or putting too high of a price tag on children, has been normalized. Our right to have sex whenever we want, with whomever we want, with no consequences, in other words, access to abortion, has been normalized. And so therefore, when we as Christians suggest that children do have value, that they're not a commodity, that unlimited sexual freedom is not a good thing, that abortion is not the quick, easy fix it's advertised to be, well, we might as well be speaking a completely different language. And I think it's tempting to think, you know, if I could just come up with the right words, with the right defense, if they could just see how wonderful and loving and helpful pregnancy centers really are, then they'll understand. Then they'll know we're not harming anyone. But what we need to recognize is this, that it's not just that we can't seem to communicate with people who oppose pregnancy centers. It's that we're involved in an epic clash of worldview. And so what is worldview? So quite simply, it's how we see everything. It's the sum total of our beliefs about the world. It's the big picture that directs our daily decisions and actions. And it may be more accurate to say that you don't have a worldview, but a worldview has you. So there are three basic questions every worldview answers. Where did we come from and who are we? What has gone wrong with the world? And what can we do to fix it? So how does the Christian biblical worldview answer these three questions? Well, as Christians, we would say that God created us in his image with a plan and a purpose. We are loved. We are called to be part of his family as sons and daughters, right? Two, what's gone wrong? Sin, right? We're fallen and broken. Our desires have gotten all twisted. No matter how hard we try, we always miss the mark. What can we do to fix it? Well, we can't, right? It's Jesus who does the fixing, reconciling us to God through his death and resurrection. And by the power of the Holy Spirit, he works through us to bring restoration to the brokenness in our world and ultimate restoration at the end of time. So that's the Christian worldview. But what about this other opposing worldview that dominates today's culture? Where did that come from? And I think it's common to associate the sexual revolution with the advent of the birth control pill. And while it's true that this technology, which separated sex from the consequence of pregnancy, caused this social movement to grow exponentially in the last 60 years, the seeds of the sexual revolution were planted much further back in history than many of us realize. Now, before we dive into the past, I want to explain a term that will give you a framework for where we're heading. And that term is expressive individualism. Now, has anyone heard of expressive individualism? Okay. So, basically what that is each person has a unique core of feeling and intuition that should be expressed if individuality is to be realized. So Carl Truman, in his book Strange New World, put it this way. The modern self is one where authenticity is achieved by acting outwardly in accordance with one's inward feelings. Now, he points out that this isn't always necessarily a bad thing. But he goes on to say, the increasing social sensitivity to criticizing anyone for their personal lifestyle choice reflects a view of the world where each person is free to perform life in whatever way they choose. And any attempt to express disapproval is therefore a blow not simply against particular ways of behaving, but against the right of that person to be whoever they wish to be. And how this plays out in the context of the sexual revolution is that if an individual's inner identity is defined by sexual desire, then they must be allowed to act out on that desire in order to be an authentic person. But how did we get here? So let's go back a few hundred years. We're going to look briefly at the lives of five people whose ideas have brought us to where we are now. So the first one is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Anyone familiar with Jean-Jacques Rousseau? Okay. So he was a Swiss philosopher who believed that our inner feelings are central to who we are, that people are born pure and good, and that society, meaning the family, church, community, is what really corrupts us. So basically, sin is society's fault, not ours. And if society prevents us from acting on our inner feelings, then society prevents us from being who we really are. Now, this sounds pretty normal in 2023, but it was very radical in the 1700s. So Rousseau also believed that the state would be our liberator from society. And believing the individual to be naturally good, he was confident that the all-powerful state would likewise be good. No, not so much. And what if someone disagreed with the state? Well, that person was obviously corrupted, and needed to see that their true liberty lay in conforming to the state. As Rousseau put it, the individual must be forced to be free. So that doesn't sound sinister at all, does it? Rousseau's philosophy gave birth to the modern concept of revolution, the wholesale destruction of an existing society in order to build a new ideal society from scratch, which inspired Robespierre in the French Revolution, Marx, Lenin, Hitler, and Mao, just to name a few. You start doing the math, and the rivers of blood that flow from Rousseau's ideas are just mind-numbing. Any utopian vision that aims to build a new and perfect society always means removing those who resist. As John Stone Street is fond of saying, ideas have consequences, but bad ideas have victims. Okay, next one is Karl Marx. He was a German philosopher who believed that the economic relations between people had the most impact on their identity. And Marx viewed long hours working in a factory as soul-crushing labor, which he probably did have a point there, but that he thought this prevented people from being who they should be. And additionally, he viewed religious morality as a tool used by the dominant class, the bourgeoisie, the factory owners, to keep all the workers in line. So religion was invented, Marx thought, to make the worker class nice and quiet and obedient. He believed that religion was a sign of intellectual weakness in its adherents, a means for social oppression for its proponents, and that true freedom could only be achieved by abolishing religion. Now, next one, Friedrich Nietzsche. He was also a German philosopher and a poet. And the following quote is from his famous Parable of the Madman. You may have heard it. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I will tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? God is dead, and we have killed him." So Enlightenment philosophers had denied God's relevance and existence, but they failed to draw the necessary conclusions. And Nietzsche at least was honest enough to admit where this kind of thinking leads to. If you get rid of God, everything changes. There's no longer any moral stability to the universe. There's nothing greater to which you can be held accountable. Basically, you create your own universe. And so morality, therefore, if it's something we create for ourselves, becomes manipulative. If morality is nothing more than a preference, then those in power are just exerting their preferences on others. And for Nietzsche, the great task for humanity is to break free from these made-up moral codes and be our own masters. Next is Sigmund Freud. So now we take a turn to the dark side, in case you didn't think we were there already. So Freud was an Austrian neurologist, and he believed that sex is foundational to human happiness, and that human nature is at its deepest level sexual, even from infancy, and that human beings are defined by their sexual choices. So this is where we start to see sexual desires linked to identity. Freud also recognized that some restrictions on sexual behavior were necessary in order to maintain civilization. Because, as Carl Truman writes, if our inner voice is just this insatiable sex drive, then allowing that inner voice unlimited outward expression would lead to a very dark and violent place. So therefore, sexual urges must be curbed so that people can live together with some degree of security. However, this maintenance of civilization requires the frustration of natural sexual instincts, Freud said, which means that true happiness becomes unattainable, precisely because the avenue to it, a sexual free-for-all, is precluded. So it's the conflict between human desire and the needs of civilization that is the point at which sex becomes political. So Wilhelm Reich, this is the last one. Okay, so Reich was a psychoanalyst in Freud's circle in Vienna, and even Freud thought this guy was extreme, which tells you something. And it was Reich who coined the term, the sexual revolution. Now, remember Marx and the bourgeoisie oppressing the poor factory workers? Well, Reich applied this way of thinking to the traditional family. But now, the oppressor is the father, imposing stifling sexual morality on the wife and children, who are the oppressed subjects. And Reich believed that a new revolution was necessary. If these patriarchal sexual codes could be dismantled, then people will truly be free. Here's where it gets interesting. Who then is going to facilitate this revolution? Well, not the family or the church, because they're not going to dismantle themselves. No, the state will do so. Remember Rousseau's good benevolent state? So the state will do this by promoting sexual freedom and dealing severely with those who oppose it. In short, sex must become a pressing political issue in which the state takes a proactive interest. Reich wrote that in the 1930s, and his words have become nothing less than prophetic. So let's just fast forward a bit. In 2007, the Maryland Board of Education, in defending their sex ed curriculum, declared that it is, of course, the fundamental right of a parent to control the upbringing of their child, but that right is not absolute. It must bend to the state's duty to educate its citizens. So, in other words, the prevailing belief now is that the state, not the family, should be teaching values to children. So, connecting the dots, why are issues of sexuality so political? Well, if the state exists to help and protect people, and if the core identity of who we are is our inner feelings, our true self, and if our true self is defined by our sexuality, and if we're only authentic if we have the freedom to act on whatever sexual feelings we have, well then, the state has to protect our sexual desires, because this is how we've defined what a person is. So therefore, if you challenge someone's sexual behavior or the consequences of their sexual behavior, then this is seen as attacking not the issue, but the person at the core of who they are. So this is why sexuality, abortion, and pregnancy care ministry have all become so controversial, and why the issues have become political. Now, just to be clear, the Pregnancy Center does not get involved in politics. Rather, I'm just trying to explain why the issues are political in the first place. So what are the results of the sexual revolution? How's that working out for us? Well, in his book, Why You Think the Way You Do, historian Glenn Sunshine writes, "Despite sexual freedom, people are not happier or better adjusted. Instead, the quest for personal satisfaction through sex has brought with it skyrocketing rates of STIs, depression, teenage pregnancies, single-parent households, and, of course, abortion. But despite the rise in sexual activity, birth rates are dropping and are now below the replacement rate across the board in Western culture. Now, economics are one factor, but the hyper-sexed society combined with antenatal tendencies, so in other words, the desire not to have children, is a troubling sign for the future. And I think one of the most striking antenatal examples is China. After decades of their disastrous one-child policy, it was changed to a two-child policy not long ago. Now they've gotten rid of the regulation altogether, and they are currently encouraging their citizens to have more children. But it's not working. China's population dropped last year for the first time since 1961. And according to one official, the citizens have lost the willingness to have babies. Surprise! You drill antinatal attitudes into your people, making them fear overpopulation, forcing abortions and infanticide, and you wonder why people in China have lost the willingness to have children. Okay, so let's look at those worldview questions again. How does this other worldview, the one that has resulted from the sexual revolution, answer these questions? Where did we come from and who are we? Well, this worldview would say we're products of mindless, meaningless evolution with no purpose or destiny. We're defined by how we feel about ourselves, by our usefulness or wantedness, and if we're deemed to have a low quality of life or seen as a burden on others, then life isn't worth living. Two, what has gone wrong with the world? Society, Christians, those traditional institutions of the church and family, that's what's corrupted us. And what can we do to fix it? Just be whoever you want to be. Do whatever you want to do, no restrictions, no right or wrong, then you'll be happy. So how do those answers differ from the Christian worldview that we looked at earlier? Well, they're almost complete opposites. The Christian worldview asks, what's wrong with the world? Me. How do we fix it? God. The popular worldview asks, what's wrong with the world? God. How do I fix it? Me. So I want you to tell me if this is an accurate picture of our current society. The rejection of the belief that truth can be known, personal autonomy and freedom of choice, cultural and moral relativism, religious pluralism, the devaluation of human life, oversexed but antinatal, the rejection of any moral absolutes as bigotry. Would you agree this sounds a lot like our culture today? Well, interestingly enough, what I just read was a description of ancient Rome before its collapse. Basically, we have come full circle and have returned to the worldview of ancient Rome. I was listening to a podcast from Abdu Murray, who was describing our culture today as post-truth. So we're past postmodernism. We're now in post-postmodernism. And the main premise of postmodernism was that there's no such thing as truth. There's no way that we can know the truth. Logically, that starts to break down because all you have to ask is that statement true, that there is no truth? And the whole thing collapses. Which brings us to post-truth, which states, yeah, there probably is such a thing as truth, but I don't care. The advances in technology have reached the point that we can see inside the womb with amazing clarity. There's 4D ultrasounds, incredible documentaries that show fetal development from the moment of conception. So it's really difficult to look at all the scientific evidence we have now about pregnancy and deny it. So what we're starting to see from abortion advocates is this post-truth viewpoint. And that is, yes, we know it's a life, but it's a life worth sacrificing. So you see, expressive individualism says, my autonomy, my feelings, my preferences are all that matters. I am the highest authority in my life. Look inside yourself, follow your heart, you know, basically every Disney movie these days. But the problem with following your heart is that it's a compass that always points towards you, which isn't very helpful if you're lost. And lest any of us think we are immune to this just because we have a Christian worldview, remember how fish don't know they're wet? That compass points to our own heart more than we would often care to admit. But what are the logical consequences to this way of thinking when there's no fixed authority, no morality outside of yourself? What happens when one person's preferences come into conflict with someone else's preferences? Who's right? Who wins? Well, the one with the most power, the one with the loudest voice, wins. They get to decide who has the right preferences, whatever that happens to be, and the ones who have the wrong preferences will need to be eliminated. Now, when you reach this point, you might just be tempted to curl up in a ball and wait for Jesus to come back. I understand that feeling. But it's not realistic, and it's not what we're called to do. So where do we go from here? Realizing that we're basically living in ancient Rome now, and we know what happened to them, I think it's natural to ask, you know, are we the generation that's going to see the collapse of civilization as we know it? Maybe, or maybe not. I want to be, as Carl Truman states, realistically hopeful. Not pessimistic, as that leads to despair, and not optimistic, because that just sets you up for deeper despair later on, but realistic, to see things clearly. And also hopeful, because God is still with us, and he's still in control. This is still his world. Great civilizations have risen and fallen throughout history, and a remnant of God's people has always survived and come out the other side. But even so, nobody wants to be the ones during the falling years, do they? As Frodo said to Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." "So do I," said Gandalf, "and so do all who live to see such times. But that's not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." And Acts 17:26 says, "From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands." So each of us here today, God has chosen us to live in this particular time and in this particular place. And if that's true, then that means that we are uniquely positioned to make a difference in this particular time and in this particular place. So we're at a crossroads in our culture. There's no doubt about that. It doesn't take more than a few minutes of watching the news to recognize that wheels are coming off. And while we may think of ancient Rome as falling, it's also true that that culture was transformed. And that transformation was largely due to Christianity. The Christian worldview that all humans have value and worth because they're made in the image of God, that did make a difference. Glenn Sunshine writes, "Mostly we need to follow the model of the early church. Living a biblically faithful life will not make us popular. In the face of a culture far more corrupt and decadent than our own, the early Christians lived lives of extravagant faithfulness, even to the point of torture and death, and they won. It took over 300 years, but they transformed Roman society. We tend to get discouraged over a single election cycle." In the concluding chapter of Strange New World, Truman writes, "St. Augustine, in his book City of God, offers a vision of the church in a hostile culture that calls on the church to be the church and on Christians to be constructive members of the wider society in which they are placed. The historical evidence suggests that their approach proved remarkably effective over time. And so it may be again, perhaps not in my lifetime or even in that of my children. But God is sovereign, God plays the long game, and God's will shall be done on earth as it is in heaven." And perhaps it's helpful to think of our life not so much as a marathon, but as a relay race. And God promises us that one day all things will be made new. Amen? But that restoration is not just for the future, it's for today too. And working in pregnancy care ministry, we have countless stories of seeing restoration in people's lives. Now, not all the time, of course, because we still live in a broken world, but Jesus said to take heart because he's overcome the world. And in his mercy, we do get glimpses of that victory from time to time. And I'm sure all of you do too. When the early Christians rescued babies left to die from exposure outside the city walls in Rome, if someone had come up to them and said, "Do you know that what you're doing is going to change the world?" they probably would have said, well, I don't know about that. I'm just trying to help this kid. So what does just trying to help this kid look like in all of your lives? You know, we've been looking at the big picture this morning, but big pictures always come down to the individual in front of you. So how can you love and serve the person who's in front of you? What is God calling you to do? And it may be hard, it may be unpopular, but just remember, you're not doing this on your own. The Holy Spirit, whose power rose Jesus from the dead, is with you and working in and through you. He will guide you and help you live a life of extravagant faithfulness. Because when you do that, do you know that what you're doing is going to change the world?